brought to you by Black Knight. It's the technology.ie podcast, episode 30 for May 24th, 2012, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinichon. Dias Marievagus, Keith Falter Roivistock. Hello and welcome to technology.ie. It's the podcast brought to you by Black Knight. I'm Conor Muinichon in the Edgecast Media Studio, and we connect via Skype and reach out across the internets to find Black Knight CEO Michaela Nealon. Michaela, where are you tonight?
I'm back in the Hilton Dublin Airport again.
You practically live there these days. Where are you off to?
I'm off to Pisa tomorrow for the... It's for a meeting of the .eu Registrar Advisory Board.
Very nice.
So we'll be talking about what's been going on with .eu and, you know, some of their plans for the future. And, you know, it's always good to have those meetings because, you know, there's a bunch of registrars, the senior staff from the URID, the guys who run .eu. We get to sit down, we have a good back and forth. It's not always convivial. Sometimes it gets quite heated about, you know, things that they'd like to do, things that we'd like them to do. And, you know, stuff changes.
And you have a role here, Michaela. You're chairing this meeting, is it? Or?
Yes, I'm the chair at the moment. Okay. I'm the chair of the board.
As usual, the last few weeks, we've managed to have a guest most weeks. Introduce me to your friend this week, Michaela, who's joining us.
Well, we're very, very honoured this evening. I mean, this is a big honour. We have the President of the World.
Welcome, Mr. President.
Thank you for having me.
Barry, who will pronounce his surname himself.
Go ahead, Barry.
I will be Barry Shine.
Barry Shine. That sounds like an Irish name almost. Have you Irish connections, Barry?
No, but it was often pronounced Shin. When I was growing up.
Barry, where are you based?
Boston.
Very good. And when we say President of the world is your business. What is the world?
World is an ISP. Has been for a long time. It's theworld.com. We've been in business since... we've been in the internet business since the fall of 1989.
Very good.
About October 1989. We first founded the business to do other things, but we got into the internet in 1989. Excellent. So been doing it ever since.
Excellent. I'm going to ask you a bit more about what you've been doing since later in the show. That'll come up in part two. We'll kick around the news a little bit first. I have to say, Michaela, when you sent an email to Barry and said it being celebrating 20 years of the internet in Ireland was what kind of prompted you for this. And, of course, I misread it. I thought you meant Barry Flanagan of Ireland Online. But no, this is someone who predates even that.
Yeah, well, Barry is very, you know, he's very approachable. Sound guy, as we would say, but you know he does get to go to meetings and introduce himself as the President of the World, which is, you know, it's his job title. And the World was the first commercial ISP on the planet. I mean, I think there might be some argument about that, but if it wasn't the first, it was definitely one of the first. So Barry's been around for a very, very long time. He's his CV makes for fascinating reading, and I'd say he probably knows where most of the skeletons are buried.
Very, very good. Well, we'll be asking you more about that, Barry, as we said, later in the show. Let's talk about some of the news this week, Michaela. First of all, Twitter have updated their terms of service, and they're adding support for Do Not Track. What's that about?
Well, this is part of this the entire kind of privacy thing. I mean, the idea that you can opt out of being tracked online. I mean, that's the simple view. The other interesting thing as well is that I'd say that this newsletter thing that they've also started, it's to build more engagement, because I think we've touched on this in the past, that Twitter, in common with a lot of social networks that aren't Facebook, might have a large number of registered users, but would have quite a small number of active users. So when they started sending out these newsletters, I'm not 100% sure on the frequency, because I've got a lot of Twitter accounts, so I'm getting lots of emails. I'm not sure which ones I'm getting them for. But they're doing things like sending you emails with highlights of work on Twitter. So it's a bit like the kind of stuff you're seeing on Memo Lane, except this time around, it's kind of the highlights. It's kind of interesting. I don't know. Barry, you're not a Twitter user, are you, Barry?
Not really. I've used it. I have an account, but I use it from time to time, more to monitor a current event, that sort of thing.
But you're a bit, you're more of a Google Plus head, I think, aren't you?
Facebook and Google Plus, so to a lesser extent. But yes, I'm on both daily. Yeah, certainly.
I'm not sure I've noticed these newsletters, Michele, but I'm not sure I welcome them either. I don't, you know, I'm inclined to think Twitter is great. I use Twitter a lot. It would be the main thing I use over Google Plus or Facebook. But I don't really want to get a letter from them. I haven't time to read them. My email inbox is full enough as it is.
Well, I could tell you a story about my email. I'll get to that in a minute. but no, you can opt out of them. I mean, this is the thing. You know, I'm probably getting a lot of these emails because I tend to opt in to newsletters from various different services, because I'm always interested to see, you know, what kind of new features and services they're rolling out. I'm always fascinated as well to see how people are actually wording their email newsletters. And some of them do a very good job and others do a really, really bad job. So, you know, I look at that to kind of, you know, in some ways for kind of inspiration. And plus, hey, if we've got to do a weekly podcast, it's not bad for a bit of material, you know?
That is true, yeah, without a doubt. And I mean, certainly I'm interested in newsletters for certain kinds of services that I want to be particularly engaged with. But when it comes to Twitter, I think, you know, yes, Twitter is great, but I'm interested in the people I interact with on Twitter and not so much in the company themselves or in anything they might be trying to sell me or in any kind of rapport or engagement they might be trying to build with me. I guess in a way, Michele, is this kind of courting of its users perhaps prompted by the Facebook IPO and maybe Twitter's feeling a little bit needy?
No, I wouldn't see the two as going hand in hand. I mean, I'd see it's more to do with, you know, engaging and driving more interaction from those users who don't already use Twitter actively. I mean, for you, you're not in that demographic. You know, you use Twitter and, you know, you're happy with that and you have your interactions. But, I mean, there's a lot of people, if you go look at their profiles, you know, they might be following one or two people. They might have tweeted once or twice.
Yeah.
And, you know, for any of these services, I mean, ultimately, if they want to start selling advertising, they need to have active users as opposed to millions of dormant accounts.
Speaking of Facebook, we nearly forgot to say anything about it this evening. Any thoughts on last Friday's IPO?
I think Barry would be a good person to ask about that.
Oh, yeah, I have lots of thoughts. I guess my most recent reaction to listening to a lot of the news was that I just hope all these people that were so negative and knew that Facebook was going down made a lot of money shorting the stock. they certainly seem certain of their opinion of which way the stock was going to go, and you can always make money on the stock going down if you're certain of it. So far it's not that dramatic. It's down to about, what was it, about 31 today, and from 38 open to 7 points. It's not good news, but you know, it's hardly what the doom and gloom some people have predicted. It would have been nice if it went to 50.
It seems to be the trend with IPOs recently that they do tend to fall off from that initial price. But from Facebook's point of view, you know, this is they've got the money in the bank at the price that they floated at. That obviously is more important to them. Some people suggesting perhaps that they should have floated at a lower price. If they did, they'd have less capital now to work with.
So he was fully subscribed, yes. They would have less cash. But, you know, they have to think forward also.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be selling a lot more stock, especially as the lockup period ends in 90 days. And, you know, they're taking a chance of depressing future sales. So it's an ongoing, it's not a static situation. You know, you've got to think a year or so in advance and look at how stocks are going to be floated out into the market. And make a strategy out of that.
It really is too early to be talking about it at this stage, 4 days into it. But it's certainly been interesting to see this and to see this IPO and see what will. It'll definitely be worth watching. It's going to change, I suppose, how Mark Zuckerberg runs his company, how the business is run in the months ahead. It's now a public company. He's got shareholders to answer to. public shareholders, and it's going to be much more interesting, I think, to watch now. Let's move on. Something else that came under my attention this week, Michele. Dublin Web Summit, we talked about it, I think, last week or the week before. Got an email from them this week to say that not only have they moved to London and run an event in London, I think they had the London Web Summit, if that's not, that was recently, I think it was. They're now bringing that Founders event, which they ran in conjunction with it in Dublin. They're bringing that to New York, it's reported now.
I mean, New York is one of the, you know, the happening cities. But though, of course, you know, a lot of the tech stuff tends to go on the West Coast. Mm. I mean, there's a lot of money in New York. If you're looking for funding for anything, I'd say you're probably going to end up in New York at some stage. So it seems like a logical choice.
There was an email as well from them. The founders of Dublin Web Summit are launching some kind of a stealth mode startup as well. I won't even go into it. I can't even. There's no point really. There's no information about it. You can sign up and find out more if you're interested in doing so. But it's certainly been a success in Dublin in the last couple of years. It's something we talked about a couple of weeks ago and referred to a blog post on Damien Mully's blog, which highlighted as a result of a Freedom of Information request that the events which were run in Dublin and also in London had support from the IDA and Enterprise Ireland. You were saying that story's been picked up now by the mainstream press, if you like.
Yeah, this month's, not this month, it's the June edition of Business Plus, print edition, has a little sidebar on Molly's findings. And of course, you know, I mean, Molly's an active guy. He's very involved with a lot of things, and he keeps his ear to the ground. I mean, of course, you know, last week we had the social media awards, which was
congratulations.
A fantastic event.
Congratulations, by the way, Michele. Black Knight did well.
Yeah, well, we did. I mean, we won the best blog of a business award, which I'm quite happy with, must say. And Bert is very happy as well.
That's the Bert.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's Bert the Dragon, your marketing mascot.
He's one of our marketing mascots, because Squishy is the original mascot, Squishy the cat, who's currently, you know, a little bit busy with the other cats in Nantes. So, you know, Bert is taking over while Squishy sorts things out at home.
Very good. I was talking to Damien today, actually. He's coming to County Clare next week to talk to some local business people about how they can succeed online and on the internet. We're going to be featuring him on the Small Business Show, the radio show, this weekend as well. But we'll move on, looking also at the news this week. The Irish Independent have an article here which is reporting on the antitrust warning served to Google by the European Competition Commissioners this week. They're concerned that this is something that that we've kind of touched on before, I think, Michele. There is concern in Europe and by the Commission that Google is getting too dominant. It's has too many fingers in too many pies, and that when you do a search on Google, Google services are given too much prominence.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we talked about before. I mean, previously, I think we were touching on this because there was a group of other companies, some of the review sites, particularly in the travel and hotel industry, and also, of course, Microsoft, who are trying desperately to make Bing a viable competitor. Mm-hmm. But this time round, you know, it's the European Competition Commissioner, so that puts it in a whole different light. I mean, I think this is something, you know, we're going to see more and more of. What's going to come out the far end of it, who knows? But it's an interesting one. I mean, the stuff there in that article, you know, Google may be copying original material from the websites of its competitors, such as user reviews, and using that material on its own sites without their prior authorization. I mean, going to be a really touchy subject for other companies. I mean, if you're running services that rely on advertising revenue, paid impressions and all that kind of thing. If Google's just pushing that stuff out and it's taking its costs, it's a very, very touchy area.
It's ironic, really, because we're talking about Microsoft as being the underdog here, really, in this case. And it's not so long in our memories. Of course, it's an eternity in terms of how fast things happen in the world of technology. But not that long. We're talking just, you know, maybe a decade or so since Microsoft itself was the focus of antitrust cases in Europe and in the United States over alleged abuse of its dominant position. The shoe's on the other foot in the world of the internet now, isn't it?
Well, very much so. I mean, with the Microsoft, in terms of, you know, the desktop software, server software, and even some of the SaaS offerings, you know, it's holding its own. But when it comes to the internet side of things, it's always been a little bit of the underdog. It's never quite managed it. And, you know, talking about Microsoft and search, there's a very interesting article in this month's .NET magazine. They've got an interview with one of the guys talking about Bing and what they're trying to do there. I mean, the idea that search is all about verbs, it's about actions, it's about you know, solving a problem. You know, you want to go to the cinema, you also want to have something to eat, all these kind of things. So I don't know, I think they're still trying to find their feet. I think there's another story we were going to look at very briefly, Colin, which was about their new social media network thing.
That's
which
right.
I can't even pronounce it. I suppose it's like social without any of the vowels.
What's .cl? Is that something like .me or .co, or is it one of these trendy new two-letter top-level domains?
No, it's Chile.
It's Chile. Fair enough. So they've used it so.sl or yeah, so.s or so.cl, I should say. Social, I don't know. It's a new social search research tool. Now, they're not even going as far as to describe this as a beta product, Microsoft aren't, but it is, they're saying this is just a research tool. You can try it out, sign up for it. And ironically, you sign up for it using Facebook.
Well, you've got two choices. You can either sign up using your existing Facebook account, or you can sign in using your Microsoft, what are they calling it these days? A WAS passport? What's it now?
Windows Live.
Windows Live. Yeah, they keep rebranding the damn thing.
Yeah. This is.
But you can't sign up. You can't sign up with that unless you have an account on one of those services.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's dire, Michele. It is. This is worse than an amateur kind of. Well, I won't say worse than an amateur kind of product, but this really is. This is on the bench. This is up on the lift. This is you know, this is something that's jacked up with the wheels off. You know,
it's yontastic, dude. It's yontastic. I mean, I logged in. It was really, really, really slow to load.
Yeah.
I mean, incredibly slow. And I'm on a fast connection now at home. I'm like on 75 megs at home. Mm. I've got 100 megs synchronous in the office. I mean, it's not as if I've got a slow connection.
Yeah.
It took forever to load. And then when it loaded, I was kind of looking at it and going, now what?
No, it's...
I was like, nah, I logged in once. I haven't gone back.
Did you get a chance to check out Sokol or Social, whatever it's called, Barry?
No, I haven't looked at it yet. I'm curious. I'm thinking right now I should check it. Not right this moment, but...
You're not missing anything.
I'm not?
No.
No.
No. It's okay. Take it from us. Take it easy. What about you, Barry? Are you what do you use for search, getting back to Google and Bing and all of that? Do you use Google? Have you tried Bing? Do you think it's credible?
I use Bing occasionally. I mean, 95% of my searching is with Google. You know, I'll admit I tend towards Google. Once in a while, if I think somehow I'm not getting a result I want, I might try Bing, but it's much the same. It's rare that solves whatever problem I have. So, you know, it's like going to one library or another. You tend to find the same book.
Mm. I guess, though, and we've talked about this before, the way, for example, that the Google search no longer includes the Twitter data, the Twitter real-time data, the Twitter firehose, if you like. I got to say, Michele, that is something I miss. And when I do a Google search now, I find myself wondering, you know, I'd like to see what people are tweeting about this, and I can't get that in Google at the moment.
No, and that was some kind of contract thing that they had with Twitter, which expired. It's unfortunate because it was quite interesting. But what's also interesting is what Google's been doing with Google Plus. Now, Adrian Wechler who we had on the show, must be one of the first shows we did, if I think back on it.
I think so.
He did a very interesting piece in last Sunday's Sunday Business Post, talking about the issues surrounding Google Plus, and, you know, how there's very little there. If you log in, you don't have any contacts. Mm. But what's been interesting to see is, you know, doing searches now on Google, you're able to see things appearing from Google Plus. And they also, the e-consultancy had an interesting blog post, I think it was yesterday, about how some of the brands are now being highlighted. But another feature which I noticed, and I don't know if it's got a huge amount of coverage, is if you search now for an actress or any other public public figure or a film or a TV show, it sometimes displays a whole range of content on the right-hand sidebar. So, like, you get like a kind of Wikipedia style entry, and, you know, posters of films and all that kind of stuff appearing. I mean, they're very much kind of enriching that entire search experience.
That's right. I was going to talk about that this week. It's called Google Knowledge. Knowledge Graph, I think, is what they're calling is what that is. But it's mostly only available in the United States. I think you may be browsing as someone US based when you see that, Michele. Are you?
It's possible.
Possibly.
I've got all sorts of weird settings at home on my home connection. So, yeah, I'm not seeing it here, and I'm connected. Yeah. This computer thinks it's in the UK.
Right.
It thinks I'm in London, actually.
what do you feel about that, Barry? Are Google effectively, bringing in that kind of social information in the first place into the search, the search plus your world, I think they're calling it. Do you think that's effective? And this extra tinkering they're doing now with Google Knowledge Graph, is there a risk? Is there a danger here? They could break it.
Well, I think they're running in a lot of directions with Google Plus. I use Google Plus quite a bit, and I think it's trying to find, you know, some unique niche for itself. Because obviously Facebook has established itself. They're like the Microsoft of social media and chatting and so forth. So they're trying to enrich the experience. I don't know if that's what people are after. I don't know if that's what people really want from their social media. I don't pay a lot of personally don't pay a lot of attention to it. I tend to just jump into conversations. Discussions, as most of my users would just look at all the postings. Facebook seems, I don't know, have a little less friction conversationally.
Less friction on Facebook.
Less friction on Facebook, mm-hmm. That people tend to just put out a little snipe or remark and somebody answers and somebody else answers. They move on. Whereas Google Plus seems to me like it's always a stream of almost like just looking at a lot of blogs, personal blogs. Mm-hmm. There's like, yeah, you know, somebody puts up an article about something they're outraged about, which seems about 90% of it, and maybe somebody says, "Yeah, me too," and then it goes on to the next one, or they put a photograph they thought of a cat or something they thought was cute. Whereas Facebook seems to have a lot less friction on the conversational end, which I think a lot of people find attractive.
I'm gonna ask you, I suppose, Barry, about. You know, you mentioned at the start about how you started the world as an ISP in order to answer a need that you felt you had yourself at the time. I'm going to ask you more about that and how you feel the tools we have now compared to the kind of tools you had 22, 23 odd years ago. We'll do that in part two of the show. Let's take a quick break. Michele, Black Knight Solutions, you're offering domains and hosting. Do you know what I did this week, Michele? Actually, for the first time, I transferred a domain to Black Knight. And it was painless.
Well, it should be. I mean, it shouldn't be a painful experience. I mean, there's certain things you have to get right, obviously.
Yeah.
But
it was a new experience for me. I had a domain with GoDaddy, actually, and I wanted to transfer that to Black Knight. And I'd never transferred a domain before. It's not one that's doing anything in particular, really. But I just wanted to give it a go this week and found out it was, you know, easy enough to do. You have to unlock it first with some domain registrars can lock, isn't it, a domain, and you if, against accidental transfer or anything like that, had to do that. There was a couple of back and forth and authorization keys and things like that, but all very painless, I have to say. What is it you want to? What is it you're doing this week? You're still hiring. How's that going for you?
Well, we've got a bunch of people start. Let's see, we've got one guy on a placement for a couple of weeks, and we've got two developers who started, and there's a few other kind of changes we've made internally as well. We're moving people around because part of the thing, we went from having, 1.5 staff to having two, to having three, to having five, to having 10, and now we're heading towards, the 30 staff mark. And, you need to kind of reorganize things internally so that, people's heads don't explode. So there's we're doing a lot of internal reorganization, but we're still hiring staff as well. So we're always on the lookout for talent. In terms of promotions and things that we're pushing at the moment, we still have our Be Happy campaign to push .be domain names. We're still doing giving away a 30-day free trial of the GoMobi site builder. And that's actually proving to be quite popular. And also the guys in GoMobi, and we were talking to Francesco last week, they've been rolling out new features over the last couple of months, and they've other things in the pipeline. And actually, I think Francesco's going to be doing a couple of blog posts on our blog for us just to go over some of the cool features that they've added. And the other big thing that I've been trying to push is reminding people that they can now register COUK domain names for up to 10 years.
You're still so excited about that, Michaela. I'm happy for you.
Well, it's one of these things. It's like, see, the problem, Con, is this. Like, a few years ago, you could only register .ie domain names for 1 year. You could only register COUKs for 2 years, .eus for 1 year, while you could always register .com for up to 10. And what was constantly happening was the people were coming along, they were registering, say, their .com domain name for 2 years or 5 years or 10 years or whatever, registering the other domains, and then have it running into all sorts of problems when it came to renewals because, they'd miss out on the renewal emails and the domain would expire and their website would go offline and, they'd have lots of headaches.
Yeah, this definitely does help. And if you have a lot of domains, it's great to be able to say, okay, that's that, taken care of, checked off the list for 10 years. And it's not very often you get a chance to do that with something and say, okay, that's sorted for the next 10 years. You can find out more about all of that, of course, on the award-winning Black Knight blog at blog.blackknight.com. And well done to you, Michaela.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
You're listening to the Technology.ie podcast with Conor Muinichon and Michaela Nealon. We're here every week and we usually have a guest. This week, our guest is Barry Shine, president of theworld.com. Nice one. And it is an ISP. It was the first commercial ISP, Barry. First to offer dial-up, you were saying, to regular customers all the way back in 1989. What prompted you to do that?
Let me split that here. We were the first to offer internet access to the general public, all right? Individual accounts. The only other two ISPs that existed at the time were only selling high-speed lease lines to companies, for thousands a month or whatever it cost back then, $1,000 more a month. Whereas, we got into that whole $20 a month type of business for anybody who wanted email or whatever. And it was actually my relationship with one of those companies, UniNet, that got me into the whole thing. I knew the founder, the CEO of UniNet. He called me one day and asked me if he could put some equipment, a rack of equipment, into my office space. We were doing software development and that sort of thing at the time. And I said, sure, certainly, because he was in the Washington, D.C. area, and he needed to service customers where I was in the Boston area. And that was the best way to do it, was to haul a trunk line up to Boston and then fan out from that equipment. And he asked me what I wanted. And I said, And I remember I said, all the bits I can eat. And he said, what does that mean? And I said, I'd like to sell individual accounts. And he said, done. Because I knew that, you know, cash was tight and this was a nice sort of barter arrangement. And so we bought a big server, or at what at the time was a fairly beefy server, and a Sun 4280, if anybody remembers those. And started offering, you know, and five modems on my credit card, five, and ordered five phone lines from the phone company and put them on a bookshelf. And from there we grew, you know, from there we started selling individual accounts.
Wow. At what speed?
The modems, 2400 BPS.
Ouch.
That was hot. That was cool. You know, that was...
Wow! And what kind of demand did you find, or what kind of response did you find to this when you marketed this, when you told people, "Hey, sign up for an account, and we'll sell you dial-up internet"?
Well, not much, but and it wasn't just dial-up. People get to us also over the internet, but certainly the innovation was putting people on dial-up, you know, from their homes or whatever. Not that many people own modems. There wasn't that much reason to own a modem. Mm. So that was certainly one problem in the market. A lot of people they sort of knew what CompuServe was or MCI mail. That already existed. It didn't – none of them were attached to the internet. There was even whatever preceded AOL. Steve Case was already doing his CompuServe-like service. And there were BBSs, bulletin board services. We actually found a market to tap, which was at the time the economy got terrible. Mm. And people lost their accounts at, we had that big high-tech ring around Boston. And they lost their jobs, so they lost their access to the internet. And so we would send flyers to human resource departments. Here, you know, hand this to anybody you're laying off. We'll sell them an account, and at least it's one conversation that you can short-circuit. Yeah, $20 a month seems reasonable because a lot of these people, even at that time, felt they were in the internet business or something like the internet business and felt that was the only way they could get another job or that would help, that sort of networking even back then. Even, you know, the internet had been around for a while. There were quite a few people on the internet, nothing like today, but it was not, the internet itself was not new. I'd been on the internet since about 1977 myself.
What was the internet experience like in those days, Barry? I mean, are we talking about terminals? Are we talking about just command line access? What were you offering? What kind of machines were your users using for perhaps to access the internet?
Well, by 1989, PCs were pretty popular already. PC had come out in about 83 and was already... at least, you know, as a true personal computer, people didn't really expect to hook them up to networks. Mm. They just use them for word processing or whatever. So we had a lot of those. We had to support those. There was very little graphics. It was mostly command line. It was all text, electronic mail, text, electronic mail. Usenet was very popular back then, which were tens of thousands of discussion groups on various topics. It still exists. We still support it. But it's practically forgotten. There's about 150,000 topical groups that really, really are fairly active even to this day. And people that knew about them. They were very popular in the universities back then in the 80s. So a lot of people already were, you know, that was sort of their social network. They would go into these groups and they would discuss, and they would argue, sports, cinema, whatever, you know, various topics. There was some posting of graphics, but that was very clunky. You know, you had to download something. It might take an hour, and then you could look at it on your screen later. You download it into a disk file, and then use some other application to put it up on your screen.
I remember that distinction very, very much between, say, PC and online. I would have been in college, say, in the late 80s, early 90s, and the internet, like you say, it was Usenet, it was stuff like that. It was we would have accessed it through, let's say, the mainframe in college at the time, the VAX digital mainframe in college. Whole load of dumb terminals in a computer room. And I remember the ironic thing. I went to college in Galway. I remember the ironic thing at the time was that we weren't allowed on the internet. We could, you know, there was all kinds of stuff we could use in the college, but only, I think it was postgrads at the time were allowed to actually get out there on the internet. And if you could somehow wangle an account or get in, you know, use someone's account or get into to going online, yeah, there was a whole world out there. There was a whole load of discussions going on and some very exciting things. And then there was these PCs, and they were connected to, you know, they were graphically very beautiful and all of this, and they were running, you know, GUIs and things like that, but they weren't connected to anything at all.
Exactly. But what you're touching on by relating your experience and my experience is one of the true charismas, especially back then, of the internet that people have forgotten, which is systems like Usenet, email, and so forth were suddenly international.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, suddenly I could sit there and I could argue with you about a soccer game or something, a football game, as you would call it, on the internet almost in real time, maybe, you know, a minute or two turnaround. At worst, on Usenet, and have somebody else in Australia or somebody else in almost anywhere, but the other side of the Iron Curtain. Until that changed. But even some of that was starting to come on by 89, 90. We were starting to get Tallinn, and Moscow State University came on actually in the late 80s, actually before that. So there were a few privileged people and the Far East, the Pacific Rim in general. That what an amazing thing. I remember in the late 70s, what an amazing thing that I could log into University College London onto their computer from MIT here. You know, it just now it seems like nothing. But that back then it was just mind boggling.
And it was pre-web, but it was so exciting to be able to do that, really. I remember in, say, leaving college, I sort of came and went out of college for a few times and eventually finished up with college for the last time, I think, in 94. And went through cold turkey, missing the internet and everything. And within a year, I had signed up for dial-up internet for a service very similar to your own, the service that was available in Ireland at the time, which was Ireland Online, and which celebrated its 20th anniversary last week. And it was, I remember the package I got from them, we're talking, say, 94 now, Barry, I remember the package you got from them, it all fitted on one floppy, there was Winsock TCP/IP connecting program. There was Eudora mail client, and there was, and I remember, I think I was using it for about a month before I said, let's try this Netscape thing, see what this is about. I was actually using a terminal and Lynx browser, and I was really happy with that. It never occurred to me there was anything else.
It was Gopher. Remember WAIS, Waze?
Yeah.
Bruce McHale's Waze. There were a few attempts to do something web-like that had gone on in the early 90s.
Yeah. What was your experience, Michaela? How did you get into the internet? What was it like for you when you first went
online? Well, actually, I'm just a young chap compared to the two of you, really, in my entire internet experience. I mean, I didn't go online until 1994.
Yeah.
When I was in my first year at the University of Limerick. And similar to your experience, Con, I mean, at the time... postgrads and staff had pretty much unfettered internet access. If you were an undergrad, there were two rows of computers in one computer lab in the ground floor. It was called the Vax Lab, which, of course, they weren't Vaxes. They were, they were Dells by the time I left there. I'm not sure what they were at the time when I was there back in 94. And you had access to the internet from 6 p.m. until 10 p.m., if you could get to one of those computers in those two rows. The rest of the time, if you were one of the lucky few who had somehow managed to wangle an email address, used to go around the college campus with a floppy disk, and using that you could load up a copy of Eudora and access email. My email address was 1012@ul.ie back in 1994. And to read web pages, because you didn't have direct access unless you were sitting in one of those two rows, I used to have to use a web
What the hell was it called? It was a kind of a web to email gateway robot running from, I think it was running off UCC. It used to do send an email to this robot and say something like, you know, get me the front page of the Irish Times. So it was like, you know, get all in caps, space, and then http://, you know, irish-times.ie, and then wait, check your email, and you get back the front page, and then you have to manually type in the same kind of commands to get back all the pages from the hyperlinks on the front page. It was fun.
Yeah, but you kept doing it, Michele. It was fun because it was compelling. And there was this whole, I suppose, addictive nature of the connectivity and being able to connect in that way. It sounds funny. I mean, we're here reminiscing like a bunch of old old-timers really here, but it does sound funny when we see how easy things are, relatively speaking, now. What do you do now, Barry? Do you still offer dial-up access? Do you still how has your business changed in what is a very different internet, a very different world now?
Well, we do still offer dial-up. I mean, I still have over 8,000 phone numbers throughout the United States and Canada and Mexico, so forth. It's certainly not a growing part of my business, but you'd be surprised. You know, we get new accounts. Hmm. It's not what I would call the. I wouldn't recommend somebody going into that business right this minute. We do web hosting. We do. I don't know, but a lot of people use us to read their email. You know, we have applications that they like and all sorts of things.
I imagine you started talking about starting off there with five modems. At what point did it really take off? At what point did you feel that that you were riding a wave, or that there was a wave of interest coming?
Oh, probably about 92, 93. You know, when we first started letting the general public onto the internet, about 2/3 of the internet blocked us.
Wow.
The entire military, U.S. military network blocked us, and much of the NSF network blocked us. And, you know, I was informed of this. Remember, I had been running Boston University's internet through the 80s, internet access. So I was sort of a known factor in a lot of this. I put Boston University on the internet. So they knew my name. They knew who I was. I mean, we knew each other. And they told me, they said, look, we don't know. You seem to be reselling a government resource, and we don't know if that's legal. So, you know, when people say to me, how do you know you were the first one on the internet? How do you know you were the first one to let people on the internet? Oh, boy, did I know. Oh, you know what I mean? It's like, You know, when the police show up at your door, you know, right? It wasn't quite like that. But, you know, when they start blocking you and it's on every discussion group, this moron in Boston is letting anybody get on the internet and he doesn't have permission to do it. You know, in fact, here's something, an interesting historical thing. I have a letter from the United States National Science Foundation allowing me to allow the general public on the internet as an experiment. Okay. They actually finally squeezed it through at that. They squeezed me through as, gee, maybe someday we'll have to deal with this. Why don't we let you run an experiment and allow the general public to report back to us? That was how they finally got it through their own committee, their own committees. It's an amusing letter, you know, where they invite me to run this experiment.
Do you still have the letter, Barry?
I'm sorry?
Do you still have the letter?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just bits on a disk. It was email.
Oh, okay.
It's funny.
I'm thinking of having, you know, you can have it framed on the wall.
That kind of echoes our, I mean, it's funny to think about it now, but that echoes our experience, let's say, as undergrads in the early 90s, Michele, when literally, you know, colleges didn't think we should be allowed to use email, that it would be a drain on resources, that it would be somehow subversive. That I remember even feeling, actually getting the impression, and actually, this actually happened. There was a friend of mine who went on to do a postgrad in Canada, I think, or someplace. And I remember I could keep in touch with him by email by sending an email to his dad, who was a lecturer in the college, and asking him to forward it on to his son.
Sure.
And we did this for about maybe 3 or 4 weeks. And eventually I remember my friend came back to me and said that his dad felt very uncomfortable about doing this, you know, that this was somehow giving me access to the world of internet resources that somehow wasn't for ordinary people, wasn't even for undergrads or whatever it might be.
In the 70s and 80s, it was quite explicit. I mean, when you ran an internet site, like I said, I ran Boston University, much Boston University's site, your contract said that only bona fide researchers were allowed. And I remember in the late 70s at MIT having to reaffirm that I was a researcher. They sent me something to sign that I had some bona fide research purpose, because I think it was the British Post Office had complained that technically they should be getting postage for all these mails. Okay? But if it was bona fide research, they would forgive that.
Wow.
And we had to go through a round of asserting in writing that we had a research. You know, at that time I was at Harvard, and I did in fact have a bona fide research reason for being on. I was doing medical research. I was using MIT computers for simulations. So this was quite explicit. This wasn't just policy only, and of course bandwidth was dear, so you couldn't let the hordes on. Or a lot of universities felt they may have had their entire bandwidth, likely in that time in the early 90s, was 56 kbits. Mm. That was a typical high-speed link-up.
I guess it's worth remembering that. I mean, when we laugh at it now, the constraints that were in place, we were really talking about, like you say, bandwidth was a finite resource. It was horse and cart technology compared to what we have now.
Absolutely.
Not that long ago, though, is it?
No. No.
I mean, the thing is this. I mean, looking at us, for example, when we first contracted directly with a data center for our own kit and putting it into our own racks and all that, we contracted for 256 kilobits of bandwidth. And that was back in 2003. And that was more than enough bandwidth for us to provide all the hosting that we had at the time, both emails and everything else. I mean, sure, you know, we had to up it fairly quickly, thankfully. But, you know, at 256K was fine. And now when I'm sitting at home in Carlo, I've now got 75 megabits into my house.
The people joke about Al Gore and creating the internet and all that. Well, one of the very palpable things Al Gore did was he got the funding which upgraded the backbone of the entire internet from 56 kilobit links, which was the ARPANET, to the NSFNet, which is 1.5 megabit links, what they call T1 or E1 links. Okay, he got that funding, which put a web of those links throughout the United States. And that's one of the things that allowed the internet to open up to many more universities and outside of the strictly research paradigm.
These young folks nowadays, they don't know how good they've got it. Barry, we asked people to, Michaela put a post up on technology.ie asking people to suggest questions. We've got some suggestions there, some from yourself as well. But I just want to take one of those actually and sort of, this ties in with some of the questions that you suggested we could talk about. I'll leave the boxers or briefs one aside. There's just simply isn't room to cover everything here.
Neither.
Right. But as long as speaking of covering everything, then that's fine. You mentioned Al Gore there. Let's talk about the politics for a while, and let's talk about the current state, I suppose, of the internet. Questions of net neutrality. Questions of copyright and questions of interference or otherwise by politicians and the judicial system into the internet. How do you feel about things now? How do you feel about how tightly the internet is regulated or controlled? How do you think it should be? Where are we at?
Well, you know, when the FCC, the United States FCC, issued that report, was about 200 pages. I remember I read the whole thing. And
which report is this, Barry? Sorry.
Oh, it was about a year or two ago. and on net neutrality.
Oh yes,
they had this big, huge PDF. I don't remember, but it took me quite a few hours to read through it. And all I kept saying to myself was that this entire report is addressing an issue that is years behind where the net is. They have simplified. They have made a simplified mental model of the internet. And I think that's the issue over and over again in my mind, that the net moves fast and the net changes faster than a lot of these regulators even want to think about or can, you know, those of us that live on the net, that live and breathe this kind of technical, this kind of technology, just watch the net move. I mean, what does net neutrality mean anyhow? I mean, when they say net neutrality, they're talking about bandwidth, because they can understand bandwidth, right? Not giving the same bandwidth or latency. But what about DNS? Mm-hmm. You know, what about DNS access? You know, all these things factor into neutrality. There's 20 different dimensions I could lay out that net neutrality could be argued over. And yet, you know, they don't even seem to acknowledge a lot of this.
Have we ever had net neutrality? Is net neutrality even a valid concept, Barry?
It's a complicated concept. I'm not even sure it's desirable. I'm sort of mixed. I certainly don't think that somebody should be able to punitively, apply. And so, look, the most important thing, most important way in my mind to combat net neutrality or any fears of net non-neutrality is to improve competition. You know, in the net, improve bandwidth competition. There's too many monopolies or pseudo-monopolies, quasi-monopolies, whatever you want to call them, oligopolies. And that's the real problem. The real problem is they can unilaterally make some decision like this. Well, maybe that's in the United States, they made the phone company open up their bandwidth to other business models. Other people could rent their bandwidth at a reasonable price and make other rules and other business models on the same bandwidth. Because there is this natural monopoly tendency of any wire plant or wireless plant that is capital intensive. You've got a trench and you've got a, and so forth. Well, so why not fight fire with fire and undo the monopolistic nature that might give them a chance at what people are accusing them of doing? Take that away and let a thousand flowers bloom, as Mao said. So I think there are better approaches. I think there probably are places where net non-neutrality does make sense. Not from a political or selfish point of view, but where it's subsidizing something that that might otherwise not exist.
Yeah, my feeling on it, Barry, is that it's too easy for monopolies to develop, especially in, say, a situation where internet access, for one reason or another, may only be available from one or two companies, which is often a case, and I know it is a case in large areas of the United States where there isn't a huge amount of choice in relation to who the provider is going to be. Isn't there a case that you need some regulation to ensure that competition and I suppose a level playing field is enforced by some kind of authority?
Well, yes. I mean, it's perfectly fair. A lot of these companies are legal monopolies. Hmm. Okay, without naming names, the government gives them monopolies. They don't let just anybody go in and trench up your road. They don't let just anyone set up a public wireless. Wireless is probably a slightly different issue, and one reason why it's interesting. But, these are phone companies, PTTs, you know, they're based on the same people, aren't they? That always have these. Well, if they're going to enjoy those legally enforced monopolies, then I think they're going to have to suffer regulation of those monopolies, because otherwise there's no way to control them. You can't control them with market forces. It's impossible. Once they tell you that you can't put your wires in the street, and only your local phone company or something can put wires to your house, or two or three companies, maybe your cable company. But where I live in Boston, you know, there's two, three sources of internet physically. You know, there's the TV cable people, and there's the maybe two of them, and the phone company, and there isn't much else. So that, yes, it's perfectly fair to regulate them, perfectly reasonable if they won a champ at the regulation bid. Well, we'll take away the monopolies and see how happy they are about that. We'll let anybody. Probably the best compromise is to just require them to allow people to resell their service, buy the service from them at a reasonable wholesale price, and then resell it back on their wire plants. Separate the wire plants, the physical plants, from the service offering.
Well, what about, I mean, as an internet service provider, Barry, is this, can you afford, or can you, is it realistic that you can, for you to say that I'm going to treat all the data on my system as neutral? I'm not going to worry about prioritizing one type of packet over another. Is that something that, you know, is that something that you've had to make a decision about at any stage? The reason I mention it is, for example, I know that talking to some people who are involved in providing internet service to customers, for example, the arrival of Netflix recently in Ireland caused some people to lose sleep at night, wondering how they were going to deal with that extra demand.
Yeah, the only time it's really come up was where was maliciousness or near maliciousness. That never was a legitimate service. I've always tried to be open, tried to find a way to fund what I needed in bandwidth. Bandwidth is not the most expensive thing anymore. Certainly things like spam or similar. Yes, I've been non-neutral towards spammers. Mm. Even there were times where I was looking for the BitTorrent types, just curious if they were eating up my bandwidth. I never found anything that was worth lifting a finger over. I might have found one or two customers who were clearly doing something like that. But, when I measured it, I said, this is not really that significant. Maybe others are having more trouble with these things. I don't know.
What I'm going through some of your own questions here as well. Privacy, internet privacy, you've mentioned here, Barry. Where? What's your stance on that?
I'm for it.
It's a good thing.
I mean, it's another complicated issue. Scott McNeely, one of the founders of Sun Microsystems, a very successful company. You know, he made the I assume joke where he said the privacy war has been fought. You lost. Get over it. Mm. And to some extent, that's true. I mean, a lot of the data is out there. A lot of the information we're protecting is already out there. And people are voluntarily giving it over. I think the notion of what should be private is changing rapidly. I think if you ask an 18-year-old today and you ask a 50-year-old what they thought what reasonable privacy standards, you get two very, very different answers. I mean, 18-year-olds are posting their entire life, every thought on net pictures that many of us who are older wouldn't dream of revealing about ourselves. On the other hand, there are some areas, some very specific areas, for example, bank accounts or financial status or medical information, personal medical information, where privacy is reasonable and it's very important. In the marketing realm, I tend to lean towards Scott McNeely. And what was fought, you lost. it's over.
And some would argue we haven't lost in the sense that by sharing our information, by giving people like giving organizations like Google access to certain information about us, we get a better service as a result. Do you buy that?
I think that can be true. I mean, obviously they have a. They have a motive for doing that. You know, there's the old the cliche, not so old cliche, which is that when you're getting a service for free, you're not the customer, you're the product. Okay? Yeah. You are what they plan to sell. And your information is basically what they plan to sell. Your buying habits or what you're searching for, your shopping habits. So let's be realistic here. They're going to make a living off of this, and we've got to decide where privacy exists.
I got to say, you mentioned you're a Facebook user, Barry, and I want to know what you think about this, and Michele as well. I use Facebook I suppose, in a limited way, I've only a limited interest, perhaps, in the amount of social networking that I can do on it. But when I do use it, I find it useful. I find it fun. I find it very, very. We're having a family occasion now this weekend, and it's great for planning that and for getting in touch with relatives, and it's all wonderful. I love it, you know.
Great.
But I don't like Facebook telling all of my friends what it is that I watch on Netflix, for example. I find that, and it's not that I'm watching anything particularly embarrassing, but I find it embarrassing to open that aspect of whatever it is I might be doing to tell people, you know, hey, Con has just pinned this, or Con has just liked that. I like that. That's fair enough. That's sometimes I'm doing that, and I want to send that signal, or to use a word that has been used in connection with this kind of thing. I want to send that gesture, but increasingly I find it irritating. I find it annoying, and certainly when it comes to a service like Netflix that I'm paying for, that I think is fantastic. I love the selection on it, limited and although as it is. But I hate it that the default setting for that would be that Facebook would tell my friends what it is I'm watching. Having said that, Michele, I occasionally get good ideas when I see what it is that you've watched on Netflix.
But you only see a portion of what I see on Netflix.
Indeed. So you'll say don't share this in relation to something. My default setting is don't share anything.
Well, it's with me, it's not that. It's a little bit more complicated. Because I've, how do I put this? Let's just say that I've certain services that I access in a kind of a gray area, let's just say. It's why I can see certain services before they're rolled out in Europe. Don't push me on that one, Con. You're right. I mean, there is that you have to get the balance right. I mean, I share a hell of a lot of information across Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and you know whatever the next social network that comes around the corner that I might find vaguely interesting. But at the same time, I'm also conscious of where I'm sharing it and how I'm sharing it. Because I've had issues in the past. I mean, I've had things happen where I shared something publicly and next thing I know, I'm getting quite nasty, vindictive comments being posted on my personal Facebook wall by some random third party who has issues with me personally. You know, that is a problem. So, you know, I'm quite careful about some of the privacy settings. I'm careful about sharing certain things, like when we were working on the deal with Google for getting business online, I was very careful not to check in to Google HQ in Dublin too publicly, let's just say. Mm. But, you know, I think a lot of it is down to awareness. Like my sister, for example, you know, she's taken to Twitter like a duck to water, and, you know, she works in media, so it's a natural kind of fit. And, you know, she's using that to you know, share stuff about what she's doing, about, you know, trying to find leads for people they can talk to on this breakfast show they're doing in Australia. So, hey, sister, if you're listening to the show, we've given you a shout-out to 10 Breakfasts Down Under. But at the same time, I would be worried about her as a single white female living in Sydney if she shares too much of her personal information publicly on Facebook, like, say, for example, dates of birth, those kind of things, because that's a wonderful vector for somebody who wants to do some social engineering against somebody.
In a way, Barry, you know, these privacy concerns, Michele talked about, you know, getting flamed and trolled and harassed and that online as well. We've always had this. We've had this in Usenet. We've had this in...
Absolutely.
We had this in the bulletin boards.
Absolutely. Look, anything I post, anytime I give my opinion or response, reply on Facebook, I assume, and I word it, and I judge whether to post it, I assume it's completely public and will be public till the end of time. I have no illusions about that, and I refused it. You know, and that's how Usenet was. So it's a fairly safe way of operating. Now, Netflix I don't use. But if they were posting something that I didn't like and I couldn't shut it off, I think I would end my relationship with Netflix. I don't want people, you know, I watch all sorts of strange stuff, and I don't think anything I'm particularly ashamed of, but on the other hand, I don't need people characterizing me, you know, in some sense. I mean, for example, I'll admit right here, once in a while I like good slasher flick. That really turns some people off. You know, I've had people at parties where I said, oh, yeah, I saw, you know, this or that movie, and they say, oh, my God, you know, you must have, you must be a sociopath and watch stuff like that. And, you know, it occurs to me that maybe it's not, you know, well, here I've publicized the fact. I'm not that ashamed of it. I mean, obviously, a lot of people watch them or else they wouldn't make them. But, you know, I can see where I don't need that broadcast every single time I dip into
This is the problem with online. You don't see the full context. You don't see the full person. So anything you share online, someone who reads that can make an assumption erroneously and mistake the trunk for the entire elephant.
Right. Well, correctly. I mean, I don't. You know, it might be some part of your personality, but it also may have little bearing on them. But we like to judge it. We're social beings, and we judge strangers on the street, for God's sakes, just by the shoes they're wearing or the look they give us in a moment on a public transport. We're like that, right? We make quick judgments. It's a survival characteristic. You don't need to feed that, you know, in negative ways if you don't have to. On the other hand, you know, I think the world is changing, and I think we're becoming a almost like a big global mind. And I think I don't know if the problem so much is privacy or people sharing, or is the problem people not sharing enough, you know, not expressing their opinions. Not opening up a bit to the world, you know, because maybe that's where the future lies.
I want to say thanks to David Kerwin, who sent comments via Facebook in relation to what kind of questions we could ask you. We've covered some of David's questions. We've also covered some of your own. Michaela, I know you want to ask Barry about the new TLDs, but very quickly I want to pick another one of the questions you suggested there, Barry, first, which is Romney or Obama? Go on, which are you? Or what do you think?
I am what's known as a yellow dog Democrat, which means, you know, I will tend to vote for that party, for Obama's party, or whoever they're running, except on the very extreme circumstances. But I'm a great fan of Obama's, to be honest. I'm a great fan. I don't see anything interesting at Romney myself. And I suspect that the election will bear that out, that a lot of people feel like I do, that that even if there are legitimate issues on either side, that this is not the person to represent us or represent those issues.
Do you feel in any way that the expectations in relation to President Obama were unrealistic, that perhaps people have expected too much of him, and that perhaps, you know, there is a certain amount of disillusionment, a certain amount of disappointment with the Obama presidency? Do you think that's justified?
Yeah, I've always had the feeling politicians exaggerate. Politicians, they even tell, shall we say, falsehoods, you know, promises. They make him, but you know, to me that's important anyhow, because it tells me what they think I want to hear. Mm. It tells me what sort of person they think I am to get my vote. Okay? And what somebody like Obama was talking about resonated with me. And obviously resonated with a lot of people. And whether he was able to achieve every one of those, at least I know where what he thinks I want, what he thinks that he needs to do to get my vote and my trust. Okay, whereas someone like Romney, in my opinion, he goes out there, promises things over and over again. I don't want to see happen. I don't care if he can't. I know that a lot of those things he can't accomplish anyhow. I mean, he could say he's anti-choice, but he'll never change that in a presidency. But it doesn't matter. The fact that he thinks I want to hear that means that he's misread me, and that he's not somebody I want to vote for. So I think a lot of, you know, there's the E for effort thing, you know, the excellence for effort idea, and I'm pretty happy with that. And as long as it moves along somewhat, I mean, Obama has been stuck with a Republican House of Representatives, half the legislature, and I think this is just gridlocked the government. But he's done a lot of good things anyhow. He's managed to do things, and he certainly says the things I want to hear that he's going to try to do. I mean, you only get a choice of two. You know, I think Obama put it very well. You know, he said, don't judge me against the Almighty. Judge me against the alternative. Okay? And I think that's where we get a little tripped up in our rhetoric. You know, we imagine some perfect person that can just zoom through. But, you know, as somebody has said, you know, God save us from efficient government. Dictatorships have governments like that where they can just say something and it happens. You know, it's the fighting and the resistance and the friction that keeps, you know, terrible things from happening also, as well as good things from happening. You know, there's value to the confusion.
Yeah. Michaela, you want to talk about new TLDs?
Well, briefly, because, I mean, I think, you know, Barry's touched on a whole load of different topics. And one of the things that he touched on a couple of times, both directly and indirectly, was, you know, concepts around competition, innovation, and how, you know, the entire thing changes so quickly. And, you know, I know, and the reason I know Barry, which we didn't actually go into, is I know Barry because he goes to ICANN meetings around the globe. The last time I saw him was in Costa Rica back a couple of months ago.
2 weeks ago.
And hopefully I'll see you in Prague in a few weeks' time.
I was going to say that I too am a customer of Black Knight, and I've been very happy. And I've had no problems. And I think one of the reasons for that is because I could buttonhole you at a bar in West Africa and get something resolved.
Which we actually ended up doing down by the pool in Senegal. I remember that.
That's right. Good customer support.
But no, more seriously, though, I mean, with the entire new TLD thing, I mean, you know, you've been around for a very long time. You've seen the internet grow from being something which was exclusive to academic institutions and government agencies to opening it up to Joe Public, both business and then, you know, normal end users. You've seen it grow from having, you know, just.com and a couple of other domain extensions all the way through. And now we're on the eve of this potentially massive launch or potentially massive damp squid around new TLDs. And it's just, you know, you've been following it all quite closely, I know. So, you know, what do you think? What are your thoughts?
Well, who was it? Yaakov, what's his name? Karen, I think? He published Yoav.
Yoav.
Yoav, I'm sorry, Yoav. Karen. Yeah, he published an article today where I guess he's been keeping a list of all the known TLDs, and he published, I don't know, about 100 of them. And it was interesting that are publicly announced or whatever. The reveal hasn't happened. The public doesn't know yet. The 2091 or 2019, whatever it is, applications yet. I think it's certainly an interesting development. I mean, looking at that list, if it's representative in any way, my feeling is they fall into a couple of categories. There are going to be those that will just be self-sustaining because they're not meant to be business models. You know, I think there's going to be quite a few disappointments. You know, and I think there'll be some successes and some raving successes. I mean, I think it's all the possibility is in there. They're at the mercy of the public to subscribe to these things in many, many cases. There are a few that are so specialized that that may not be the case. It's interesting. It's interesting the process that brought us to this. You know, this bottom up, you know, participatory ICANN process. You know, so this is a perfect time to wait and see, isn't it? It's too late to change anything, and it's too early to. We don't have the data on what really became of all this. You know, I think it's fine. Because, you know, nobody forces anybody to use the TLD. So we'll see how it's received.
Barry, one of the reasons we're delighted to have the opportunity that you could join us this evening, as we said, you are probably the first person to offer, as we said, internet access to the ordinary person. And as you pointed out this evening, your experience stretches back even before the founding of the world in 1989. So you've got an overarching view of I suppose, the story of the internet to date, most of it, at least at any rate. How do you feel about the way it's turned out in 2012 and where's it going?
Well, there are things I like. You know, I'm glad all this money came into it. That certainly helped a lot. You know, all the bandwidth that we take for granted today, is very impressive. You know, the fact that we can run videos and millions, you know, tens of millions, a billion people can run videos. You know, that's a wonderful thing. run all sorts of graphics and do all this thing. I guess my biggest is I'm not surprised about the crime and stuff because, you know, people like that. None of that, you know, surprised me. I could tell stories about the very beginning. I put a link, a 10 megabit link, between Boston University about 1987, between 86, between Boston University and Harvard. It was already a high speed link, 10 megabit link, to MIT. So we completed a triangle, and then we made a mailing list, an email list. But suddenly these three universities were hooked up at high speed, what then was very high speed, 10 megabits. And the first question that somebody asked, I believe Lou Law, was, if somebody from your university has something untoward, what can I do? You know, if they crack into one of my machines, crash one of my machines, you know, my own students, you know, I have a process. What do I do with your students? And theirs, and when the NSF was considering me to allow the public on, the first thing they asked me was, what if somebody, a malevolent actor, does something bad? What are you going to do? Right? And I said, and I answered, I remember Steve Wolf, quite honestly, I said, there isn't a lot I can do. I could shut him off, but he could come on with a different address. So none of that really surprised me. We've been dealing with those issues. I suppose if anything surprised me, it's that I think browsers, all the browsers, the whole browser interface, the JavaScript, the HTML, the whole thing, is I am astonished at how primitive it is. You know, when you look at what you get on a game or a game console and what interactivity can be, full interactivity, full graphics interactivity, the idea that we still have a text box and a drop-down box and a menu drop-down. And that's about, you know, I mean, there's five or six things like that. And we squeeze in something like Ajax, that real-time, you know, when you start to type, it suggests back some possibilities of what you might be typing. And that's it. It just staggers me. It's like 1980s technology, not even. You know, they're like the old, you know, half-duplex dumb terminals they used to use for forms filling. And I'm just surprised that, you know, with Java and JavaScript and all this, obviously something's wrong with all that technology. That to this day we're stuck with these simplistic, you know, forms-filling interfaces that could just maybe take a small box and throw up a little bit of graphics here and there. And that we don't seem to be moving past that. It was certainly not in any obvious way. You know, people have tried 3D modeling. They've tried, you know, there have been a lot of efforts. And they're always talking about HTML5 and, you know, whatever, you know, the next thing. But it's been very slow to move. And when you look at what goes on with game consoles and, you know, true interactive, you know, that's what I envisioned. The net being more, you know, each window, each tab being more, more open. I don't know. That's my big disappointment. I'm a nerd. I like technology.
Do you think we might be now? Again, you see, I would maybe, with my limited view of things, say perhaps we're about to actually jump away from that limited interface. Perhaps we're about to, with the move into mobile, with augmented reality, with some of these other elements that we're talking about now. We may be able to move. We may be about to make that leap, or to make some kind of a quantum leap in terms of how we use the internet. Or do you think, maybe with a longer view of things, Barry, that maybe we're not there yet?
Well, mobile's a little better. I mean, the interface is more open. They're not limiting themselves to a browser, right? Mm. You're getting full graphics. But remember, you know, in 1984, when X11 came out from MIT, where we had remote windows. That was a full graphics package. That was the kind of thing you could write, you know, games in. You could write something like, I don't know, you know, these commercial games in. It had that kind of power. That was 1984. So, you know, they've been promising us ever since that something's going to change. Mobile, a lot of its advantage is a small screen and the very closed architecture. I don't like that either. You know, the architecture should be more open. The screen should be bigger. The you know, it should extend to everyone everywhere. So, it might be a prototype of what's to come, or it might just be taking advantage of a particular technology.
What about Google Glass?
I haven't seen Google Glass. Google Glass. Those are glasses.
The Google Glasses, I think they call them. Yeah.
Headset thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's the augmented reality. I mean, people are playing with this kind of thing. I mean, you could see, you know, this kind of thing. A lot of it is, if you watch science fiction or even, you know, porn, I mean, you know, they've been playing with this virtual reality stuff for decades now. Well, this overlaid reality type of thing. You know, I think didn't Shallow Hal kind of deal with this in 2003? You know, this idea of illusion versus reality. Simone, you know, with Al Pacino. I think it's interesting. I think it still has yet to find its level. You know, its audience and its purpose. I mean, it's all great. Maybe we're there. You know, that's why I say to myself sometimes. You know, in my darker moments, I say to myself, maybe we're there. Maybe this is as good as it gets. You know, don't you? You know, you think that, right? Maybe this is. Maybe we'll get a little bit better, a little bit flashier. Maybe they'll finally get videos to play smoothly with a little more bandwidth, because, you know, we all know that's pretty early stage. But maybe we'll see what we're going to see for the next several years. I don't know. People certainly don't want to pay a lot.
Interesting that you mentioned science fiction, because that's really what's needed in a way, is something that gives you a leap of the imagination. Forget about what we can do with technology we have right now. Imagine anything is possible. And in a way, though, I'm not sure that science fiction has dreamed up anything that inspiring either.
I don't think science fiction ever conceived of the ubiquity, you know, the entire internet in your pocket type of thing, and connecting people the way people are connected today. You know, the way you've been announced that you're at some bar and have somebody show up who always wanted to meet you, or that kind of thing. So I think the social aspects are almost boundless.
What about you, Michele? Are you excited by where we're at now? Do you think are you disappointed? Do you think we could be moving faster, going farther?
Well, I mean, it's look, you know, mobile is the prime example. I remember back, when was it? Must have been the mid-90s or possibly late 90s, when there were a lot of people talking about mobile and how it was going to change things. And remember, you know, things like ASCII porn on a Nokia 6310 over a terribly slow, I don't know what the hell kind of connection it was, but it was damn slow. And, you know, mobile was meant to change things. And now we're seeing a lot of really cool stuff going on. But, you know, it's like some of the stuff we talked with Francesco about last week. You know, there's so many people doing apps, and yet they're missing the obvious things. And, you know, Barry's points about user interfaces, I mean, yeah, he's on the money. I mean, it's something, it's still so incredibly rudimentary and basic and lacking. But then I look at, you know, my iPhone sitting here beside me, and it's like, you know, you swipe things, you touch things, or on a Mac now you've got all these multi-touch gesture things. And, you know, there is some innovation there, but it's really, really slow compared to other things. So, yeah, I don't know. It's changing, it's moving, it's something. You know, I think the jury's out on a lot of it.
Well, I'm happy. I'm easily pleased, I have to say. And I'm excited about where things are going now. Particularly something that interests me a lot at the moment is the whole ability to synchronize things between your mobile device and your PC and stuff like that. I find that hugely good, hugely worthwhile. I mean, it's a simple pleasure, I know. And we're going to talk perhaps a little bit more next week, hopefully, Michele, about Google. But today I installed Google Drive, and I'm just... It's very simple. I'm just charmed by it. We'll talk about that again. But it's a simple pleasure. And, you know, it's been a wonderful pleasure and a wonderful opportunity. The fact that I can talk to you in the Dublin Hilton Airport Hotel before you fly out tomorrow, Michele, and we're in a conference call with Barry in Boston. Barry, what's it like in Boston this evening?
Perfect. I mean, I haven't been out much because I've been sitting here. I'm going to go out there, go sit out on the porch for a while, on the front porch for a while, watch the sun go down. But the weather's been absolutely lovely, which has been a break because it's been raining for the last few days.
Well, it's wonderful to talk to you, Barry, and really, really good to get your insight onto, I suppose, the history of the internet as we know it. And it's been a real pleasure, Barry. Thank you very much for joining us on
Technology. Thank you for having me.
I mean, thanks. I mean, Barry, just again, you know, thanks so much. I mean, we really appreciate it.
You know some very interesting people, Michaela. Thanks for bringing Barry on, and thanks to both of you. Barry, perhaps we'll do it again.
I hope so. Let's do it again soon.
Thanks to both of you, from myself, Conor Mwinachon.
And myself, Michaela Nalan.
Until next week, Slán go fóill.
Slán go fóill.